This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS Senior Financial Analyst Jill Schlesinger. I read investment newsletters from time to time, and there's this investing trend called ESG, which sounds like a food additive, but it isn't. So explain this to us, would you?
Oh, gosh, that's great. So what is this? ESG stands for Environmental Social Governance, and it is an investing theory that goes like this. If I can find the companies that do well on the environment, that do well on social issues, that do well on governance issues of their own companies, then those are the companies that are more likely to actually do well over time. And this really started as more of like a value proposition. I think now more and more investors are saying, hey, the data are starting to come in. And the companies that do well in these three areas actually have better returns over the longer haul.
I see. So this is not just about doing what's right. This is also about doing what's profitable.
Exactly. I had one host in a much smaller market than this one say to me, like, this sounds like hippie investing. I was like, okay, if you want to call it hippie investing, then maybe you don't want to find the next Tesla. Maybe you don't. You know, maybe you don't want to actually find the companies that are the most innovative, or you don't want to identify even the big established companies that are making these moves and getting their businesses more aligned to a stance that is friendlier to the climate, because that is what's going to be necessary to thrive in the future.
Now, was part of this to punish companies that don't behave responsibly?
Well, I think that the roots are certainly the negative, the contra factor here. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you go back to something called socially responsible investing, that's probably what you may have heard of, back in the late 80s. Right. This was a philosophy that was, we don't want you to actually do business in parts of the world where things are really objectionable. For example, this was part of the divest movement in those companies doing business in South Africa. And it started on campuses across the country. And students were protesting and saying, like, hey, we don't want our endowment dollars put into these companies that are actually doing business in South Africa. So you're right. There was a punitive part of it. Or we don't want to actually invest in tobacco companies because we're worried about how tobacco is addictive. And, you know, funny, if you go just sort of flash forward, you might find that, like, hey, maybe something really important to you is that, like, hey, I want legal cannabis companies that are going to thrive. Well, some of those might be big tobacco companies that enter that business. So there is some problem with just trying to be very focused on punitive and not allowing for what is the growth part of the company that will thrive in the future.
Okay, so you're saying that the companies that do good prosper. I certainly know that when you watch these image ads for companies, they're all using windmills and the wildlife nuzzles up to their pipelines and stuff. But I mean, is that true? Because the criticism of environmental responsibility is that it's way too expensive to make a profit. If you're going to confine yourself to expensive solar and windmill energy, the trope goes, then okay, you may feel good, but you're not going to make any money. So what's the truth here?
Well, I think the truth will lie somewhere in between. There's a couple of things that I think are important, and that is that, you know, you see a beautiful, huge energy company put out a little something with a green flower on it. Oh, we're celebrating Earth Day. Well, congratulations. You're ravaging the Earth with 90% of your revenue and 10% you're trying to figure out a solution. But I think that what is interesting is if you look at the money that's being pushed into this area, we find that $1 in $3 of total U.S. assets under professional management, that could be a pension fund or an endowment, and it could be a mutual fund, that $1 in $3 is actually targeted to sustainable investing. It's a 42% increase just over the year 2018. And so what's amazing to me is that I think this is not a bleeding heart hippie idea. Mm-hmm. We are learning that the investment in ESG is paying off. McKinsey says that the ESG proposition correlates with higher equity returns. Morgan Stanley Institute for Sustainable Investing finds that ESG funds have fared really well, and amid market volatility, they've done pretty darn well, and they've had less downside risk. So I think that there is really a movement afoot to make sure that we are aligning our value systems as well as our desire to be long-term investors that thrive. And also, you know, you want to make sure that you're not investing in anything really awful, I guess.
Right. So when we hear these car companies saying that they're going to dump the internal combustion engine, this is actually being market-driven. This is profit-driven. This is not just for the sake of their TV ads.
I think it is being forced because the world is moving in that direction. And so if all of your future customers want energy efficient vehicles that don't damage the environment, it would behoove you to actually get on that. And you'll notice it's so funny. It used to be that, you know, when a big company would talk about ESG, they would say, oh, well, we don't want to like make our clients nuts. The car makers out there, the big tobacco, the big oil, we don't want to drive them crazy. Then you find out that all of them are saying, well, actually we need to pay attention to this. Now, look, there are still risks in doing this because, you know, it's very difficult to figure out how the evaluations of these companies is done. In other words, I can say to you, here's how we evaluate a company that has revenue and cash flows, and this is what the market would value this at. But if you don't have a uniform way of addressing that, you may not be really measuring the right thing. And also, just think about this. What if E is really important to you, right? The environment's really important to me. And you have a great company that's doing wonderful, environmentally fabulous things. And you find out they're a terrible company when it comes to diversity in their organization. How do you feel about that? So ESG lumps in three very broad categories. Some of, you know, one which may be more important to you than another.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Little fire response going on there at the Upper West Side as she was talking to us.
I was going to say, that's so New York.
Yeah, I know. I'm surprised that most of them are so quiet, you know, in the background, because it's 3 hours later there, and then there you go. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Nobody who's had COVID wants to get it again, but suppose you could make $7,000. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And Dr. Cohen, there's going to be a challenge trial in the UK where they are recruiting people who have had COVID to be reinfected. They'll cut them a check for $7,000 and they'll study what happens. I know that these challenge trials have been fairly controversial. How will this be used?
So in the UK, the University of Oxford has decided to proceed taking people in a specific age group, 18 to 30, who are young and healthy and in the lowest risk group for being severely ill. And they want to purposely expose them to COVID to see if they can be reinfected. They're basically asking the question, do the natural antibodies that you produce from having a COVID infection actually protect you?
Because as you point out, this is the same kind of virus that causes the common cold, which everybody gets every year.
Right. So nobody really knows. Their thinking now is obviously not whether or not the vaccine works, because those trials have already been done without challenge trials, but rather they're hoping that it will help in the development of some sort of a therapy, which is still the thing, like we talked about last year, that is sort of the panacea. If we can have a pill that we can give people that makes them better and takes away the illness, then that would be the ultimate thing. But they're hoping that somehow this study will help to elucidate a treatment that could be useful. But obviously the opponents of it say, well, wait a minute, you're harming somebody. You could potentially kill somebody. And in some ways, you're taking advantage of a financially vulnerable population, people who are willing to actually get reinfected or attempt to be reinfected with COVID for $7,000.
Yeah.
So the ethics of it are complicated, and the potential benefits of it are not clear.
Well, I mean, one thing you could possibly learn, it seems to me, is why we have these breakthrough cases where people who had the vaccine came down with full-fledged COVID. I mean, you want to get to the bottom of that, don't you?
I mean, it could have some potentially important implications, certainly for people who have had COVID infections and think they're protected. Maybe they're not as protected. Maybe they do need the vaccine. It is recommended now that people do get the vaccine, even if you've been infected in the past. We also don't know even the answer to whether or not we're going to need a booster for the vaccine every year. So now you can see the next challenge trial being one where you take people who are already vaccinated and you wait till they're a couple months out, and then suddenly you're purposely exposing them to COVID. You know, I think it's a slippery slope to start going down, and I think this is not going to be the way that we're going to get the most useful information. And I think the ethics of it are such that when the medical ethics community is this divided, that it generally probably isn't a good idea.
They've now, of course, opened vaccinations up to just about everybody, and once again, the signups are jammed. A year from now, I assume that this will be always lurking in the background. Will this just be mixed with the flu shot so we can get back to the routine of getting one vaccination once a year without a reservation and to just be on our way?
Well, even as somebody who has a doctorate in pharmacology, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the actual pharmacology of mixing different types of technologies. So the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which are the two that have shown the least problems, are mRNA particles that are wrapped in lipid nanoparticles, and that's being injected into your body. Whereas the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine use, you know, weakened viruses as carriers or as vectors to get it into your body. So the question is, can you take a flu vaccine, which is older technology, often using a weakened virus or a killed virus, and mix that with this mRNA technology into a single shot? And I don't know the answer to that, nor have I heard it discussed by anybody yet. But my suspicion is that you probably cannot do that. Even just the preservation techniques between the two would make that probably impossible. But it is likely that, you know, you would go for your vaccines and you would get two shots and you would get a COVID vaccine and a flu vaccine at the same time. The problem is we still don't have enough information about the COVID vaccine. I mean, just this past week, the CEO of Pfizer came out and said, well, it looks like you may actually require a third injection in order to achieve full immunity.
Really?
Well, is it just going to be a third, or is it going to be a fourth, or is it going to be annual? I mean, we absolutely do not know the answers to these questions. With any vaccine, when you first develop it, you know, you need to understand, is the antibody response to the vaccine sustainable or not? And I don't think we know the answer to that. So as with everything that's been happening with COVID, we've been sort of learning on the fly as we go. And because of the ability to communicate around the world these days and all the scientific collegiality that exists, we've moved things along at a pace that's never been seen before in order to deal with the pandemic. But there still remains so many unanswered questions. And I think we'll be answering those questions for years to come.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
As COVID-weary as our population is there any way you can get people to pay attention to yet another COVID message? How about taking a Seahawks legend and pairing him up with Dr. Fauci?
You got Marshawn Lynch here, man. Pleasure to meet Dr. Fauci himself.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Mark.
Marshawn Lynch quickly got down to business, telling Dr. Anthony Fauci why people of color are hesitant to get the COVID vaccine.
You don't mind if I be myself, right? Okay, well then, you know, it's a chance that I can come out of this situation more up than I went into it.
All right, so let's go there.
They talked about the African-American community's distrust of the government and the lack of access to healthy diets and adequate health care that can lead to underlying health problems.
Diabetes is more common in blacks than whites. Hypertension is more common. Kidney disease is more common.
Conditions that put one at greater risk for severe COVID illness.
So what it sounds to me is we have a bigger problem than just coronavirus.
Fauci agreed, advocating for change, but stressing that it makes the vaccine all the more important. Lynch says these are messages that need to be brought into and explained better to minority communities.
Have those individuals that look like yourself come out and speak to these communities and these black and brown individuals on a level of which they can understand so we can last and not come in last.
It is meant to get the city of Seattle to do something tangible to address homelessness, but the key changes to a proposed charter amendment appear to be softening the commitment to that. Let's get details from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The proposed ballot initiative would tweak the city charter in order to require certain actions by the city to actually make a visible difference on homelessness and get people housed. When it was announced on the first of this month, the idea was...
For too long, our city has allowed this problem to continue to get worse and worse and worse. And people in Seattle want a compassionate response, and they want something done.
That's Aaron Goodman with Soto Business Improvement District, who's part of Compassion Seattle, the group of unlikely allies made up of neighborhood activists and homeless advocates. And while the group's goal has not changed, the language in their ballot initiative has.
So these changes really follows some discussions with various area organizations that are committed to resolving Seattle's homelessness crisis. So we've updated the language, provided a little bit more clarification, specifically around what this amendment means for the city of Seattle.
Mike Stewart is executive director of the Ballard Alliance and part of the Compassion Seattle group. It says there are really three key changes.
So the updated charter amendment, it includes new languages that ensures that the city would really take a person-centered approach to fixing the crisis, noting that, you know, any work relocating people to housing should avoid any possible harm to individuals caused by closing encampments. It's kind of a first important point.
So a bit of a softer touch than the original language when it comes to keeping the parks and sidewalks clear. But the second change
also reaffirms that the city would have the ability to close encampments that create, problems related to public safety or public health, or interfere with the use of public spaces by others.
And the third change
is that a sunset provision was put in place. So meaning that, assuming this was passed by voters at the end of this year, 6 years later in the end of 2027, the charter amendment would then sunset at that point in time.
Why the sunset clause, ending the mandate after just 6 years?
Well, the hope would be that after 6 years' time of really taking a new fundamental approach with a significant amount of accountability built into it, that we will have, as a community, really gotten a good handle on this issue, this important issue, and then meaning, a charter level mandate would not be required at that point. That's certainly the hope.
Stewart says the changes were made based on various feedback they got following the initial release, and that the bottom line is this gives the charter amendment the best chance of actually passing to get something done.
I think there's a tremendous amount of support and it's growing. And I think Seattleites are absolutely compassionate. 100%. And I think we've all just been looking for what is the right solution. And I think sometimes people perhaps appear less compassionate, but perhaps only because we feel like the programs that we have in place right now just aren't working and aren't doing the job.
The one change not made anything to address concerns about this being an unfunded mandate on the city. But Compassion Seattle remains committed to its position that the city of Seattle has the money to cover the investments in shelter and other things required in this amendment to pull from other areas. It just doesn't say which areas those should be.
So, Hannah, what does this mean for the regional approach to homelessness that we...
The when I talked to the people behind the charter amendment originally, that was their intent, was for this to work along with the regional homeless authority. So that I haven't heard anybody on that RHA really concerned about this at this point. But remember, we have the new CEO of the RHA who's just kind of getting into that job, and we haven't seen a lot of activity there yet. So it'll be something to watch for sure. This the real deal with what they've done here, which is last week they refiled this proposed ballot initiative with this new language, and it centers very much around encampments. The original version said that the city shall ensure the public spaces remain open and clear of encampments as permanent housing is available, or emergency and permanent housing is available. This says, the way they've reworded is that it's kind of
it is the city's policy to make available emergency and permanent housing to those living on shelters so that the city may take actions to ensure that public spaces remain clear.
How do grammar changes fix this problem? Seattle's problem is that that's where the services are, right? People move to these camps because they can't afford cars and they got to be able to walk, I assume, to food banks and therapy and medical care. And so the burden falls on Seattle. But my understanding is that not everyone is from Seattle.
Right.
They're from all over the county. So why not spread these places out?
Well, and it's not even the goal is that one thing that does stay in this proposed ballot initiative is the requirement on in the city charter that the city immediately open up 2,000 more shelter beds and some of that being permanent housing. So that's a very, very big deal. And that should remain the sticking point now. And what about this story is that they have said they've taken the shall and turned it into a may as far as clearing those encampments. So that when this first was announced, the feeling was, oh, this is awesome. Right. From people who want to see the parks and the sidewalks and everything clear and all the tents gone, because it would have mandated that the city do that. This makes it a strong suggestion, I think. And which is some people, critics say it's kind of like our current policy. But again, this is going to be in the city charter, the most important document the city has. So the idea would be that it would perhaps be done more efficiently and with a sense of urgency.
Anna Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated, a colorful local couple making a quirky donation. It's the subject of today's daily dose of kindness from a special guest to the feature, Cairo Radio's Diane Duthweiler.
Everett resident Kelly Johnson.
A derelict vessel is one that's basically just been abandoned. I mean, it begins to rot away, it can sink.
Kelly tells me her husband, Phil Johnson, read that the state gave Snohomish County $50,000 to deal with derelict vessels this year. Not enough to get rid of them all.
So he picked up the phone and he started reaching out, and we finally found the Northwest Straits Foundation.
They wrote a check to the nonprofit matching the state contribution, $50,000.
With this donation, they said that they would be able to really up the game and finally focus on some of the bigger items that they've had to let linger.
Kelly says along with being an eyesore, derelict vessels are a threat to the environment. And
they can snag other vessels. They can snag fishermen's gear. It's just heartbreaking. And it's not as if you can go out there yourself and do anything. It's not a one-person solution. It takes a team of professionals to address something like that.
Kelly says they can afford the donation. Her husband founded two coffee companies and did well. Her work history includes time in the press office of the Carter White House, and she still works as a business manager for rock and roll bands.
A longtime dear friend and client, Stephen Stills, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, has just released the 50th anniversary edition of Deja Vu. And there are a lot of alternate takes and a whole album's worth of outtakes that have never been released before.
The idea behind the Johnson's derelict vessel donation?
I hope that in some small way it'll help bring more awareness to what they're needing to achieve.
But as the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished.
Strangely enough, between the time we gave that donation and now, there's a derelict vessel right out in front of our line of vision here overlooking the beautiful Salish Sea.
And Kelly says so far, there's no plan to remove it.
That is Diane Duthweiler reporting. And now we've got a daily dose of cuteness. My 2-year-old June just woke up.
Say hi.
Hi.
Hi, June.
She's just waving like crazy at Sully and Dave on our video conference.
Say good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, that's close enough.
That's how I feel in the morning.
Good morning.
Here's G. Scott. You ever been in a self-driving Tesla, G?
Yes, I have.
And what did you think? I was in one once, and it was butterfly inducing.
Yeah, I mean, it was good because we were in a parking lot. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. I was solid in that case. And I know that you can be on the freeway. You can kind of sit there and let it kind of be on auto drive and all that stuff. And it's cool, but call me old school, Dave, but, I just really not too comfortable. You know what I mean? I'm not used to it. It's just not, I mean, I loved the Jetsons as a kid, your boy Elroy and all that stuff, and yes. Thought that maybe we'd be having flying cars by then. but I don't want you to call my bluff. You know what I mean? Like, I'd rather just stay with the regular old school cars.
And there's not very many on the road, I imagine, until they are the majority on the road. It is, there's still too many variables to feel safe. That's how I would feel. So does it take turns? You like type in an address and it takes turns for you and stops and goes and all that?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No, no,
so
no,
this
no.
is just like it'll drive on a straight freeway.
Right,
I guess
right.
I don't know how far Tesla goes in their self-driving.
Well, right. I think eventually they want it, you know, to be able to drive itself, and you can blow your whistle, and it will summon itself to you, you know, right. pick you up. But this comes up because of this crash in Texas, where a car crashed into a tree, catches fire, and when the responders get there, there's nobody in the driver's seat. They're belted into the passenger car side and the back seat. Neither one survived. Two people in the car. And so it's scary, but it's been pointed out to me that if you look at the statistics, right, you're still much safer in a car with all these self-driving features than you are driving yourself.
So they don't know what went wrong here? They don't know why it crashed or how
it... tree, yeah. It couldn't detect the tree, I guess.
It couldn't detect the tree, I see. Okay.
Well, before cell phones, right, and we were probably talking about this, and you'd say, you look at the statistics and everything, I'd probably have a bigger argument. But now with what we're seeing on the roads, you guys are seeing folks, they're on their phones and they're texting and they're on social media as they are driving. We know that that is a problem. So when you factor in that, yeah, we could probably make a case for these autonomous cars being safer than some of these cars that we are driving, considering all of the distractions that we have in our car. And by the way, even if you aren't on your cell phones, look at our screens in our cars, right? Like, just get away from the cell phone. You get the screens, and you media here and change the source and the aux cord and all this stuff going on in your car, all this technology to add to the distraction for you. So, yeah. I can probably make a case to why autonomous cars might be safer.
Another mystery to me in this car crash is that firefighters had to call Tesla at one point and ask how to put out the fire. The car produced a fire that firefighters couldn't put out. It took 4 hours. What is it? The battery?
The battery doesn't need oxygen. It's thermal runaway, basically. And Boeing had this problem with the battery, and the only way to contain it was to make sure it was in a fireproof box.
Yeah, right? You got to put it in a box with no oxygen. And so again, you couldn't pay me enough money to put me in one of these cars of any stripe at this point.
So you wouldn't roll in a Tesla, bro?
Heck no. No way. No way. And I certainly would not get in a Tesla or an autonomous car and not be in the driver's seat.
Well, there goes your Tesla endorsement.
Well, yeah, well, whatever. Until they can make a car that's affordable and doesn't catch fire, yeah, I'm pretty sure that they're not going to be looking to me.
Colleen, you probably won't beat that this week, just so you know. you can hang it up for the rest of the week. Come back next Monday. That was your best for the week.
All right.
But let's also be clear. The problem was that it crashed into a tree. I mean, otherwise, I don't think it would have caught fire. And I know that in my... I'll call it a test drive with a close friend. The problem was that when the fog line disappears, like for an exit, the car kind of gets confused.
Driving on I-90.
That's how many lanes? There's so many lines.
You can't see that with your own eyes.
I know. Now, so there. All right.
I'll admit, Sully, look, I'm going to go ahead and jump into the same seat with you as far as there goes my Tesla endorsement, because I, for about 5 minutes, wanted a Tesla myself, and I went to go and check them out. And the one thing that stands out to me, and Tesla drivers, don't be mad at me, but I promise every car looks the same.
They do.
I mean, every car looks the same. I'm like,
isn't there only three colors too?
Nobody modifies it. Nobody does anything to it. It's just like doo 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 doo. They just whoa. I can't do it. I cannot be in a Tesla. There's nothing about my personality that says Tesla, no.
Boy, when they play this back 100 years from now, you're all going to sound so silly. But in any case.
Scott's back at
9 o'clock.
See you guys.
With Larry Sloan, Cairo Radio. The first property tax payments are due by the end of the month, and property managers are sounding the alarm over increases that are driving spikes in rental rates. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Property taxes were increasing even before the pandemic, and while there was some flexibility for property owners early in the pandemic, that's not the case in 2021.
They are rough. We just received those, obviously, for 2021.
Chris Dobler is with Dobler Property Management, which manages 5,700 units in Pierce County.
Our housing providers will be paying over $1.7 million in property taxes this year. It's difficult to imagine doing that when we have, with our company, we have over 300,000 in rents delinquent due to the eviction mandate, the pandemic, and obviously a lot of our residents are out of work.
Here's what the numbers look like.
We have, as an example, a 30-unit apartment community here in the city of Tacoma, $7,200 property tax increase in 2020, and then the property taxes are now going up for 2021 or over $19,000. So in just 1 year during the pandemic, when we're not even able to collect full rents, we've got a 40% increase.
The governor's eviction moratorium remains in place until at least June, not only barring most evictions for non-payment of rent, but also freezing rent increases for most existing tenants. So here's what's happening.
And that, as an example, will go be passed on to residents. And that because we're not able to raise rents, ironically, the new residents who are moving are the ones who are, if you will, enduring the burden of this. And so for that property, it's a $110 increase alone in monthly rent for a new resident there, just for the property taxes.
The rentals Dobler manages are what's known as workforce housing.
And so it's affordably priced, but these rent increases are not affordable. And when you consider, Hannah, that we're talking about just a $110 increase to a new rental rate, and about half that would normally be what we would try and do for a current resident, that's just for property taxes. That doesn't include water, sewer, trash, which has all increased this year during the pandemic. And in addition to that, insurance is another big cost. We've also seen payroll go up a lot because of the eviction mandate. And because we've had more residents at home, there's more wear and tear on the apartments. There's more toilets being flushed. There's more cabinet doors being slammed. There's more dishwashers being used. So all of our payroll expenses are up in addition to the administrative costs of implementing all these changes that have been required during the pandemic due to the eviction mandate and the learning curve and all of the administrative costs for that. So it's been a very expensive year in addition to those kinds of property tax increases.
Dobler says they had hoped for some help on property taxes.
A lot of disappointment in the industry and with our company. We were in hopes that there would be some flexibility since we haven't had full rent collections since obviously over a year ago.
And while the latest stimulus and the state have funded some programs to help both renters and landlords, that does little to address the issue of property taxes. Dobler's concern.
And this is not just unique to City of Tacoma, but as an example, we've had clients who say they will no longer build or buy in the City of Tacoma due to all of the increases they're being hit with. Some of them are much higher. This is a 40% increase in the example I gave you. But I've heard of some housing providers facing 70% increases.
So I thought there was going to be some forgiveness or at least a delay in the deadline for property taxes, given that the landlords are stuck in the middle here.
No, they did that in 2020. They allowed that flexibility, but that's what she's saying, that is not the case. They have to pay. Most everyone has to pay this year. I believe there is some exception for seniors and possibly for veterans.
Wow. And if this discourages investment in new rental properties for what we like to call workforce housing.
Workforce.
Yeah. So this just makes the whole housing problem even worse at a time when that's the last thing you want to see.
And it's a really, really big concern. On top of that, so as you heard there, she's saying that it's new renters because of the eviction moratorium that are being hit and have been being hit with these $100 increases. That's going to, I mean, already the increases prior to the pandemic, I think 35% year over year property tax increases total, from 2013 until right before the pandemic.
That's why rents had gone up so much. They had doubled. I think I've told you this on the air before. When I first moved here, I moved into an apartment in 2010, a two-bedroom apartment I paid $785 for. And that was when I moved out just a little less than a year ago. It had gone up to $1,475. Wow. It had doubled. There was nothing changed there. And that's a very common story for any renter in the whole state. And that is going to, that's already driven some of the housing out here, and it's just going to exacerbate that issue on top of people who, you know, there's some federal stimulus dollars and some help from the state coming for landlords and tenants as far as mitigation funds go, but it's not going to be enough in the long term is what she's saying.
Yeah. And the sessions were just about over, so
we got a week.
Okay, so you're not going to get anything at this point. The other issue, capital gains tax, what's the update on that?
So there was a House Finance took up the capital gains tax on Friday, and I believe voted it out of committee. So it should come up on the floor for the Senate here soon. I believe there were some significant changes, though, made. So the version that had been passing had the taxpayer fairness account, I believe is what it was called. Mm-hmm. And that's where they a certain chunk of that money would go there. And it was about it was very much tied to the working families tax credit. That was taken out, as my understanding, on Friday. And as well, there was this emergency clause that was added, and I think they're going to end up stripping that out possibly in the Senate, but there's a very new, there's new language in there that basically makes it referendum proof, doing it without adding the emergency clause, in other words. So
why would you take out the taxpayer fairness account? I thought part of the justification for this was, in fact, to help that overtaxed low-income segment of the population.
And I am not sure, but I think that you're still going to see this go towards somehow to help taxpayers. Originally, before it was linked, you know, there's a part of it had the other version in the House that they originally had was very much linked towards the child care increase in child care and education. So I believe that's still intact. And then there had been discussion about possibly property tax relief coming from a capital gains tax at some point. So that could be something that comes up. I'm going to keep a close eye on it this week and see what they end up doing with it. But I know that there's a significant chunk of it that will end up being used to somehow balance this for your lower middle income people is the idea.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.